want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Insurance Leaders Podcast.
What would you say are some of the issues you see, you know, with underwriting, and how could you make those things better?
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, a good point where I was an underwriter longer than I was a broker. I think on the broker side, you see really interesting things around buying habits, what the clients want, whether it's a Fortune 100 or all the way down to smallest mom and pop organization or business. So really interesting to see that. And then I reflect back on underwriting and really focus on profitability, bottom line. I think that's kind of been lost over, I don't want to say lost over time. And I think ransomware attacks really woke us up to.
Do you want to hear about the latest developments in the cyber market and learn best practices and thought leadership from cyber insurance and security experts? We talk all things cyber insurance industry, international growth, cyber claims, and more. Welcome to the Cybersecurity and Insurance Leaders Podcast.
Hi, Anthony, and welcome to the show. Really excited to have you.
Great for having me. Thanks, Anthony.
It's definitely my pleasure. You know, it's always great to get to talk to different industry leaders. People have had such great experiences, and the things they're doing is pretty interesting. Just with the cyberspace changing so quickly, even today, even though it feels like, you know, 20 plus years in, it should be relatively stable. It just seems like, you know, all kinds of cool new approaches coming along. So. Thanks again. But yeah, let me ask you some questions about yourself and your team, and then we'll kind of jump into to the interview. Yeah, first, you know, tell me about yourself first and what you do.
Yeah. Cool. So Anthony, thanks again. Really appreciate this. Little bit about me. So I've been in the insurance industry for about 20 years now. Actually started out outside of insurance and venture capital for a very, very short stint. Wasn't for me. I was kind of behind the scenes in the venture capital world, working for a software company, and then went to the Hartford. So I learned E&O at the Hartford, did some MPL, a lot of real estate agent E&O, a lot of wholesale brokerage work, and then started to work on their tech and cyber products early days. Left the Hartford in 05 and went to ACE, which obviously is now Chubb. So I spent close to 11 years at ACE, helping to manage cyber tech products, did a lot of cross-level professional liability span. And then my last role there was running field operations for professional liability and tech and cyber. Was on Target, was on Anthem, was on some of the big ones. So I had great experience on the underwriting side there. And then in 2016, I had an opportunity to go to the broker side. So I went to Willis Towers Watson, led their global cyber practice, started up their cyber risk solutions consulting practice there. Spent a few years at Willis Towers Watson, and then went over to Lockton to do the same thing. So while I was at Lockton, leading their global practice, putting that together, and I had this crazy opportunity that came up with a venture capital firm that I was on the advisory board for to start a new MGA and raise some capital and build out a team, and that's where I am today.
Okay, cool. Well, that's exciting. Well, maybe you could tell me a bit more about your company then. What are you working on?
Yeah, absolutely. So Converge is a cyber MGA, or early stage MGA. Looked at the cyber insurance market over the past few years, obviously saw some of the great things that the more traditional incumbent insurers did, saw some of the really interesting and innovative things that the newer cyber MGAs brought to bear through technology and scanning and cybersecurity. And Converge is exactly as it sounds. It's bringing together kind of the best of underwriting fundamentals, utilization of technology, use of cybersecurity data to offer innovative coverage in different areas for cyber insurance. So we look at a couple different areas of the market. We have some niche products, and there's a lot more to come.
Okay, interesting. So just in terms of geographies then, what would you say you're really focused on?
So right now we're focused in the States for early days, but there's some interesting international opportunities that we'll be expanding into.
Yeah, it's been looking at the cyber MGAs. You know, I guess it's more recently, there's been a lot of expansion, you know, in particular into Europe. So it's kind of, it's interesting to see as a market.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, definitely the take-up rate into Europe. A few key channel partners in Western Europe that we're focusing on. So a little bit about Converge and what's different. We have access to data that's different. We have a different underwriting methodology, which has been really cool to see come together. But a lot of the insurance that we provide and are providing are through different types of technology and cybersecurity partners, where it's a channel to their customer. And there's some really interesting ones in Western Europe. And then there's even an MSSP that we work with that's expanding into Australia. So we see some interesting international segments in the near future.
Okay, interesting. So, you know, in terms of clients then, is it a wide variety, or is there a specific size that you focus on or specific sector that you're focused on?
So all of our offerings are built for really any size organization, but you'll see us initially more towards that smaller segment.
Okay. And I guess the last question I like to ask to kind of intro the company is, what would you say your strength is as a team in cyber, like, or as a company?
I'd say our strength is our team. So we have some really, really good people that are experienced and just extremely knowledgeable in both the insurance side, the cyber insurance side, and even our tech team comes from some really good companies that are really built in foundation in cyber insurance.
Yeah, I guess out of, you know, so many of the sort of newer generation cyber MGAs, I guess that's been something that the ones that have survived and have grown and seem to be doing well, they have that nice balance of the tech and the insurance side.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in this day and age, there's a really good way to build some proprietary technology. I mean, we have access to data that others don't. We have a really cool platform that helps with underwriting and risk assessment, but then there's also great ways to license some of the more operational data. And really, there's been a lot of road paved on how MGAs and some insurance companies have been dealing with legacy systems. And I think starting up a new MGA and taking the best of certain areas and putting it together in a more cost-effective, but even operationally effective manner has been a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. It's interesting. So you've been a broker, you've been an underwriter, and now you've launched an MGA that, you know, from what you're saying, seems to have some maybe unique abilities. What would you say? Let me try to think of an approach to this question. So just in terms of, you know, looking at all your experience, looking at the things you're doing today, what would you say are some of the issues you see, you know, with underwriting, and how could you make those things better?
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, a good point, where I was an underwriter longer than I was a broker. And I think on the broker side, you see really interesting things around buying habits, what the clients want, whether it's a Fortune 100 or all the way down to smallest mom and pop organization or business. So really interesting to see that. And then I reflect back on underwriting and really focus on profitability, bottom line. I think that's kind of been lost over, I don't want to say lost over time. And I think ransomware attacks really woke us up to, hey, we need to look at data differently. Really need to get under the hood a bit more on cybersecurity and technology infrastructure and kind of be smart about premium adequacy and how we're pricing. So let's say one of the things that was learned and where I had past frustrations was, number one, underwriting fundamentals, making sure premium adequacy and risk selection are good for the company, but also market competitive. Number two, it's just how you use the data in underwriting. There's so much data that we have, and I think it does get past just an outside scan and then coming up with a premium. And we've always complained, like, well, there's so much claim data. How do we tie that back to the information we're taking in an application? How do we tie it all together instead of waiting 9 or 12 months to look at results and then add in new questions or change rates? How can we do that in a more fluid, effective manner? And that's what we're solving at Converge. That's been great to see.
Okay. So this might be a bit of an obvious question, just listening to some of the things you're saying, but I'll ask it anyways. What are your thoughts on outside scanning? I've had different conversations with people, you know, is it enough? Is it not enough? Is it useful? Is it not useful? You know, do you think outside scanning is adequate? Or, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
It's useful. It's a data point. It's useful. I think it's needed. It's one piece of a broader puzzle. I mean, early days, I was anti outside scan. I'm like, how, you know, what can be gleaned from this kind of, you know, looking at public IP traffic and some vulnerabilities. There's a lot more because it all gets down to the employee at the end of the day. Most of the time, there's human negligence. There's lack of managing a system adequately. But over time, and the more I work with these companies that do a lot of the outside scans, I think it's a really important part of the information security puzzle. I think it's really important to understand what that public surface looks like. It's something that we do ourselves, but does it equate to 50% of the risk assessment weight? No, it's at a much, much lower percentage, and we couple it with other data. But I think it's a good, you know, use whatever cliche you want, a tool in the tool chest, if you will.
Yeah. So risk assessments then, you know, what kind of thoughts do you have on that? Like, how can that help somebody with cybersecurity, let's say, some of the things that you're doing? Or what are you saying?
Yeah, I mean, for us, when I say risk assessment, it's more about how we underwrite based on outside data, but then behind the firewall data. Mm-hmm. And there's data we have even in an aggregate basis, which is really interesting. And then some of the partnerships I mentioned, we have insured specific data behind the firewall. So when I say risk assessment, it's how do we pull all of that data together, use the unique, it's more of an adversary focused underwriting methodology to do it in an automated, very fast fashion of what is their score that Converge deems them to have. And I think that's effective in how we underwrite. And then some of the information we can kind of put back, and that's more prescriptive to the policyholder. I think risk assessments in general, that's a whole other conversation. But when we say risk assessments, more of that automated proprietary scoring.
Okay. So if I'm a security practitioner, let's say, you know, how might it look? What kind of benefit could I get?
Yeah. It's getting a lot more, better coverage, and then based on the security stack that's in place, and we really optimize, what do you have that works? What do you have that doesn't work? Where are you weak? Where are you strong? And in the areas that are weak in a prioritized manner, where do you get the most effective security spend? Where do you get that bang for your buck? Because in the SME space, obviously we don't have the $200,000, $300,000 annual budgets or more. So it's, I need to be secure. Maybe I'm working towards a SOC 1 or SOC 2, but I have a few grand to spend. Where should I put that money to get the biggest return? And that's the prescriptive feedback we give.
I think it's interesting you mentioned some of those, you know, larger assessments that people do. As an SME, I do think for us being an SME, you know, obviously we're not a very large company. I think a lot about this because obviously we're an SME filled with security practitioners. Like that's all of us do. So we're obviously pretty secure, but it is interesting using claims data or using response data to inform your prioritization. I think it's definitely something we do, but I don't know that a lot do that. They don't always know. This is one thing I loved about insurance. It kind of tells you like, you should worry about this, this, and this before anything else.
Yeah, I completely agree. It's I feel like with all the data that we've finally seen, and it's been what, like 15, 20 years now, we're almost like the NTSB, National Transportation Safety Board. Like, and it's going to be more fluid than that, but we know you have to have the airbags, the anti-lock brakes. And I agree. I mean, we're a small business starting up as an MGA coming in the market, and it's been fascinating to watch how we need to think about security. Some of the regulations that are out there in different states and New York DFS and adhering to that and the things that have to be put into place. And how do you implement EDR, MDR first over using an MSSP or not using an MSSP? And even just through our own kind of journey through that. And then obviously we get the benefit of the claims data, the vulnerabilities, some of the partnerships that we work with like MITRE Corp and others, just seeing some really interesting threats that help inform us, kind of took that into our own account, but then it also helped us inform what we're giving back to the policyholder. So it's just been, you know, I think we're kind of doing what we're saying, which is fun, but yeah, it's been fascinating to see it as the provider of insurance and a buyer of insurance and somebody that's putting security into place.
Yeah. It's been a similar experience for me as well. I think, and probably similar to yourself, you know, coming from larger companies, or even, you know, mid-sized companies, it has been really interesting kind of starting from zero and building stuff up. And there's literally nothing, you know, 3 years ago we had, you know, we were zero. There was two of us, you know, building from scratch. So it's definitely quite different. I could probably go on a, sometimes, you know, if I've had a few pints, you know, or at the pub, I can go on a long rant about all the things that are so different that I never expected coming from a very small business and then kind of growing through that cycle. Even though I was building service lines before, even though I felt like I had a lot of independence in the roles I've had most recently, it's such a totally different thing. And so I guess to tie it back into the podcast, it has been interesting perspective as a buyer, somebody that works closely with insurers, somebody that's used to being on the insurance claim side, and kind of coming in and seeing what it's like from this perspective, from the buyer perspective, is really interesting.
Yeah, I think it's a fun part.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, cool. I guess moving on from sort of cybersecurity and risk assessment, how about risk quantification? Like, what are some of your thoughts? What do you think it'd be interesting to talk to about risk quantification?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of it. Back when it was both nascent and kind of immature, and there wasn't much there, and we're talking really about glorified breach calculators that put out a nice visual to kind of where it is today. So, I mean, number one, my personal opinion is it's good. It has a long ways to go. And the more that you're feeding in different sources of data and you're using the actuarial science against it and you're informing it through claims is good. But I mean, over the past 6 years or so, I've seen fascinating applications of it. I mean, on the broker side, I mean, on the underwriting side, you can help quantify what a bad day could look like for a company and help you inform limits. When I was on the broker side, there were some banking customers where you used it to model out idiosyncratic risk of cyber. And some of these banks got capital mitigation off of it, which is under CCAR, which is like really, really cool to see, something that wasn't really contemplated. One of the past companies I worked with, I also was on the risk management board and worked with their general counsel and risk manager. And we used some of these quantification tools for that company to see what is our reliance on certain outside vendors. Yeah. And if that service provider went down, what would the impact be to us? And that helped inform us the limitation of liability we should be putting in the contracts, how much insurance we should be asking from that vendor. So that was really cool to see. And now we use it for portfolio aggregation modeling. And again, what is that probable maximum loss across a portfolio if something goes down?
So it's an interesting one. So I think, you know, in the past, I've seen really big, complicated risk quantification frameworks. It feels like insurance in particular is something that's been really helpful in driving that forward and kind of simplifying it a bit to more realistic scenarios, more realistic impacts. How do you, I guess, in terms of what you're trying to do, you know, you launch an insurance company and you're thinking, right, how can I model all this, or how can I gather more data? Like, how do you know what to prioritize? How do you know if this data matters or that data doesn't matter? Like, especially if you're just kind of starting out.
Yeah, it's almost like a tale of two cities, I guess. There's the individual policyholder data that I think matters the most for us at this point of time. And how can we assess a company's security posture without quantification? Just how do we know what's a good risk or bad risk? How do we get the bottom, 40%? We don't want to take that risk on, but we're going to look at the other 60%, if you will. So I think from a data perspective, what's most important is what informs their security posture. And then I think on the other side of it, that other city I referenced is what's the overall risk we're taking on. And we need to speak a reinsurer language and the insurer language because of the providers we're working with as an MGI. So really having that quantification, again, it's good. It keeps getting better, but we need that view on the overall portfolio of if something went wrong, if there was a single point of failure, if there was systemic risk in the portfolio, how does that affect us overall? So my hope is you keep getting better on the individual policyholder security posture basis. You continue to model out with kind of market standard practices on managing aggregation risk. And if you keep getting the policyholder security posture better and better, and you're looking at efficacy between the policyholder and the claims you're seeing and the questions you're asking and the claims, that's that, use a lot of buzzwords, that symbiotic kind of relationship that we want that just informs it so much better.
Yeah, makes a lot of sense. So I guess, in an MGA's position, you're going to work with obviously brokers to sell the policies and to kind of represent their clients. Maybe what is something you like to see out of the brokers you're working with? When you see this, like, and you say, yes, this broker is doing a great job. Like, what does that look like to you?
Yeah, I think it's a lot of, and I sat on both sides of it. It's really brokers that know their clients and can help them prepare with the right information to get a quote. I do think it's as simple as that. I mean, just the brokers that take the time to prepare their clients for what they're buying, what the coverage is. Hey, sorry, you got to answer these questions and you're going to get a quote. That to me is the crux of it. Okay. It's a well-prepared client that's helped by a well-prepared broker.
Okay, great. So I guess, looking at the sort of the day-to-day of what you're doing, or, the company itself, obviously, what would you say the most important metrics are to you? Like, how do you really measure yourself or measure your company at the stage of development?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of different aspects to it. There's obviously, employees are the biggest asset that you have. So it's measuring retention and well-being and making sure people are, fully productive and firing on all cylinders, as they say. It's our top line and the premium growth. It's targets that we work for. It's our net income line as a KPI, or kind of what the MGA takes home at the end of the day. And we're venture capital backed. So we have investors that we obviously have to have a return for, and we look at the metrics on how we spend the money and what's the return on that. So it is, kind of in the stage and where we are, it's measuring a lot of different KPIs. And then obviously you have things like, if you get down one level from there, we're ultra, ultra prescriptive. And I've always done this in the past on the underwriting side, which I think is fun, is measuring those renewal retention rate. What's our submission? What's our submit to quote? What's the quote to bind? What's the bind to submit ratios? I mean, it does get into a math game when you know how many submissions you need to make certain numbers each month. So those are probably the more tactical day-to-day KPIs.
Okay. Cool. Interesting. I guess speaking of, sort of things to measure, one of the things I really like to ask, folks that are on the insurance side, or, especially in an MGA, probably matters, even more, at least my experience is, either way, there's going to be a lot of focus on it, but especially it's a cyber MGA question I'd like to ask, which is, what is it out of the things that you would be doing day to day, or the things that your company could be doing? What do you think would make the biggest difference to kind of reduce the loss ratios?
I think more prescriptive risk management services that fit within a small business appetite and are easy to execute is key. It's that more prescriptive, whether it's guidance or actual tools and solutions. Because we all know we've worked with policyholders. We offer proactive services. It's a 3% uptake rate. Policyholders aren't always using those services. We're getting a ton of claim data in. We know what went wrong. But really putting that piece together in something that's actionable that a policyholder is going to use. And look, without sharing a whole lot, there's ways you can do it that's prescriptive, and you have to get it to the broker and then to the policyholder. And the policyholder we know is usually the insurance buyer. And then we have to get that to the security person. So there's a couple hurdles to jump for that information flow. So if you can solve that, that's critical. And then the other piece is, and I dealt with this at Ace and other companies too. What proactive services can you offer that's included in the premium that's going to be actionable? Like, how do you incentivize better control? Is that through broader coverage or different pricing? We have a partnership with an MSSP that we work with, and we know that there's 8 key controls that are in place, configured the right way. We have validation. Things are deployed on the endpoints. EDR is there. Active Directory protection is there. Doing phish attack simulation. It's with a company, Soul Cyber. We know those things are there. That's easier to incentivize better coverage. So we're not saying, hey, plug all this in and you get coverage. It's more of, you're an existing customer. We know you have these things. So I think that's been really interesting to watch and get information from.
Yeah, I think being able to work through that channel where you're so closely connected to someone that's going to have really in-depth visibility into the client is really helpful. You can get the adoption, you can get, it's not just the underwriting information, it's the risk management. It's actually, you know, getting to the right person, like you say.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was, I mean, in the early days, I guess, you know, sometimes they weren't that useful, the risk management things that were offered, you know, 10 years ago. It was just sort of a random grab bag of things that somebody had attached to the policy. But I think the better companies, at least these days, are offering very useful things. It's just a matter of uptake and making sure the client knows about them.
Yeah, agreed.
It's definitely, I think it's something that I'm pretty passionate about. And it was really surprising to me, you know, when I was on the insurance side, how hard it was to get people to adopt things that were free. Like, this is free and good. Trust me. Like, we've evaluated this. We can see over here what it's doing to the claims. You know, please do this thing or adopt this tool or, you know, take this training or whatever it is. But it was always so hard to make it work.
It was. Yeah, it was frustrating on the carrier side to watch that lack of adoption when we knew that we had really cool logos that kind of matched up. And then being on the broker side, I mean, you would have to be very explicit of, hey, you're going to get free phish attack simulation training. Like, yes, it's up to 100 employees, but you only have 80 and it's going to save you $3,000, which is $3,000 you can put into something else. And, you know, at the smaller companies, I think the more you go downstream, if it's kind of, again, I'm going to use the word prescriptive, and you push it, usually the insurance buyer and the person signing off on security is one and the same. And that's so much easier to get that done. But then you go upstream and you're in like that weird world of certain risk management companies. And there's such a silo between information security and risk management. And we talk about this ad nauseum. We all know it's there.
Yeah.
And I don't think insurance can solve that as much as we want to. It's just a lot of overcoming it. And companies that have claims and incidents, and you probably know this better than anyone, probably get more ingrained with each other going forward after something bad has happened. And that's caused a better incident response plan, a better way to work together. But those who never had an incident, that separation, that's causing a low uptake on these services.
Yeah, no, that definitely makes sense. I think, it definitely aligns with what I've seen, you know, the separation, obviously, that we talked about, but just, you know, maybe another side of that, people that have had an incident often are much better prepared because they realize at that point, oh, wait a minute, you know, I hadn't really, because people kind of don't believe it's going to happen. You know, and even worse, I think sometimes they'll tend to victim blame. It's one of the frustrations I've had. Cybersecurity people can be very bad about that. It's like, oh, haha, you got hit because you're bad. You did this silly thing or whatever. The reality is it's a risk. You know, it's a risk that's going to be there for everyone every day. And being able to kind of connect with people who understand how to look at risk and how to model it and make sensible recommendations is so helpful.
Yeah. And it was always to your point of, you know, those who had an incident versus those who haven't. It was almost like this spectrum that it was without fail. Somebody fell into a certain bucket. It was like those who have had an incident, they know the deal. They got really cleaned up, good process.
Yeah.
Those that haven't had an incident, but somebody in their industry did, and they're probably the ones who are like more aware, antennas are up, their ears are open. Then you have the ones that, like you said, like something was out there, you know, it was JBS or something like that, or an energy company. And it's just like, oh, they're awful because they don't invest. But it's like, you're also lacking a lot of things yourself. So it's funny to say.
Yeah, absolutely. So, cool. All right. So another question I like to ask is, if you had 10 of your peers in a room, what would you ask them?
10 of my peers in the room. And this isn't necessarily
it can basically be 10 of people that you define as a peer. So,
Probably be something not work related, just because I feel like it's 24 hours ad nauseum. So, you know, what are you watching now that's good?
Yeah, you know, that's one of our podcasts. We talked about movies. That was a lot of fun. I thought about adding more conversations like that, because you can find out a lot about people. Just, you know, what kind of TV shows do you watch? What kind of movies? I have a hard time. You know, it's... especially since launching this company, I don't know that I'm ever not working, you know, and even if I'm watching TV, I'm not really watching TV. I have the laptop and I'm kind of, you know, on the side, but,
I'm with you there.
It's, sort of startup life, I guess. Well, cool. Well, all right. So I guess big challenge. What would you say your team or company's biggest challenge is?
Biggest challenge is probably the orchestration of being an MGA. It is, you have to balance the underwriting, the pricing, the distribution, the technology platform build, and then the insurers that you're partnering with to provide capacity. And that has to be for it to work really well, it has to be very balanced and working well together. And I think that's the biggest challenge, is just to make sure that everything is connected and working well. It's been fascinating to watch.
I suppose launching an MGA these days, you know, or a cyber MGA, there's such a competition in the space with, you know, really aggressively developed companies. It as you say, there's more of a balance, but there's also more things you need to build quickly. You know, you're not just three underwriters sitting in an office somewhere.
Yeah, those days of those MGAs, like three underwriters, an Excel spreadsheet, you know, an orator on Excel. Those are gone. Handshake agreement with a Lloyd's syndicate, like stuff is gone. So existing book versus no book, loss picks, actuary in-house, claims handling in-house versus TPA. Obviously, there's carriers that are very bullish on cyber and there's premium adequacy and you can underwrite better and we're getting into the market. There's those that are established and they're happy with where they are and they'll do it in-house. There's those that like the idea of it. I mean, you see these fronting carriers and these hybrid fronts, and there's an unknown aggregate tail risk that they could be taking on. So there's a lot of caution, you know, cautionary interest, if you will. So again, really interesting to see the whole insurance market from both the traditional cyber insurance providers, the traditional P&C providers who aren't in cyber, the fronting partners, the hybrid fronts, the reinsurers, the MGAs of MGAs. I mean, it's just, there's a wide world out there.
Yeah, absolutely. Cool. All right. Well, I guess just, you know, things going on in the world then, to pivot to another question. What do you find super interesting from a current events perspective in cyber? Like, what do you see going on out there that you're like, oh, that's really kind of interesting?
Yeah, I think it's, I have to mention the Ukrainian-Russian conflict. I'm still kind of, you know, kind of juries out if that conflict is causing a decrease in some of the attacks that we used to see. So once there is a resolution there, will we see claim activity spike up? So like that's one thing in the back of my mind. It's interesting to watch consolidation in the cybersecurity world. As much as there's thousands and thousands of vendors, you're starting to see some of the bigger players start to kind of consolidate more. And it won't happen as quick as I thought it would, but I think a little longer term, you're seeing that companies aren't just point solution providers. It's like, we're not just an EDR provider. It's now getting into MDR, XDR, whatever you want to call it. But you're starting to find these well-established cybersecurity companies provide more holistic offering, which I like because it gets more to cyber risk management, if you will, and kind of rounding things out instead of just, I'm this vendor that does, you know, this thing very specifically. So that's probably a trend that I've been watching and kind of like seeing.
Okay. I guess consolidation is interesting, or, you know, what the different companies are focusing on, or maybe expanding their tools out. I do think, I guess, injecting my opinion, which I usually try not to do too much, I don't know that you'll see, like, some companies have moved from being just product to product with a little bit of services. I think that's a little trickier, or even going the other direction, you know, like consultancies that start moving into more, you know, software as a service or whatever. It's probably a little bit tricky because some always feel like they I don't want to name names, but maybe they start focusing on one or the other, especially as they scale and there's sort of financial metrics resting on one or the other.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that's part of the game. I hate to say the word game, but I think you're absolutely right. I mean, there's some of that. I guess it opens up two things. There's the metrics, right? Like, you can have incident response and there's a big pop and you're going to pay, but it's not recurring. So the annually recurring revenue is always key. So I think that kind of forces some. My big concern too, and you didn't hit on it directly, but just brings up is sometimes we see cybersecurity companies that don't have the tightest security themselves. And I think that's just, you know, there's a speed to market. There is an expense to get up the code or compliant and things, but that's something to watch.
It's a great point. You know, if you think about some of these companies that have explosively grown, and I'm again, not naming anyone because I don't know their internal situations, but when you explosively expand like that, it just gets hard to manage anything, much less cybersecurity.
Yeah. You know?
So, it's interesting. I probably a long conversation we could have on that one, but I will. Yeah,
which does bring up, I guess, because you did mention current events. I didn't mention it, but the administration's new cybersecurity strategy, and that talks about potential liability shift to the provider, and it talks about a safe harbor framework. So that's again something else to watch and keep an ear out on.
Yeah, I think the government the last couple of years does seem to be, it feels like, you know, from my lifetime, you know, people may have talked about cybersecurity. There may have been, you know, obviously things going on at the state level or for healthcare or whatever, but it feels like the last two or three years that the sort of the things the administration's doing in the US, it seems a lot more developed. It seems like there's a lot more happening. Now, where will it go to? I don't know, but you know, it just feels like there's a lot more kind of serious level government involvement. Maybe it took big ransomware to get people to really start paying attention.
Yeah, I agree. I feel like, you know, government's always slow to move. It'll continue to move slowly. Two things that I've seen over the past couple of years that I think is at least positive and going in the right direction to get maybe not where we need to be, but close to where we need to be. You did start to see some of the governmental agencies get a little bit more collaborative and aligned. I mean, you always dealt with DHS is here, FBI is here, CIA is here, ODNI was even completely kind of removed from some of the agencies that, you know, were under them. And it was like this fight for just data and power without, or information and power, I should say. And some of them didn't have authority to actually enact anything or put anything in place. So the DHS always felt like they were giving information but couldn't do anything because there was a lack of empowerment. I think with CISA now being like that ringleader and working with all the agencies, I do feel like there's a better flow of information between the Fed agencies and then getting back to the business owner, if you will. So I think that's been one good thing. Again, I think it was ultra positive, because the Treasury was always working on this federal backstop for cyber insurance for a year. I mean, it was probably 7 or 8 years ago. I was working with Treasury and providing information and helping them with modeling and how to think about risk. And it got like very, very quiet and there was some turnover. But the fact that they just published that request for comment and they're thinking about it in the same vein as FEMA, I just think is interesting and just good. Regardless of how it goes and what opinions you have, I think it's just good for the industry in general, just to know that there could be some kind of federal backstop in the eyes of TRIA or FEMA, where that is a large systemic potential risk that is difficult to underwrite, right? So we all want to have the insurance companies in business and offering insurance policies. So however that can be helped is welcome. So we'll see how those things go.
Yeah, I think the backstop question, you know, I think the backstop is there. So the governments, as you say, you know, it's not in their interest to have all these insurance companies get wiped out, have the entire insurance industry get wiped out. So you kind of, you know, I think it's fair to say you have a feeling that governments, at least in countries with major insurance presence, you know, would have to step in. So they should just acknowledge that and work on figuring out what that looks like, so they're not doing it in real time.
Yeah.
I guess I'd like to ask a few more questions about yourself, a few closing questions. How did you originally get into the insurance industry?
No, it was not by design. No, I was duped into it. But in all seriousness, so I worked for Thomson Financial. They had a software arm where I did company due diligence and valuations for emerging tech and VC stage companies. And then I did all that due diligence and valuation. I updated the back end of a software program that they then sold to VCs. And within that, I did some of the merger and acquisition reporting on venture capital backed companies' exits. And I went to a merger and acquisition symposium. For the life of me, I can't remember where it was, but I met attorneys who were reps and warranties, who were attorneys for reps and warranties coverage. And Hartford was their biggest client. Okay. I think it was like, it was the DeBerry brothers at the time was at the Hartford doing reps and warranties. And somehow, and I can't even remember the chain of events, I ended up interviewing with the Hartford. It was Hartford Financial Products. And it was probably a couple of years after they bought Reliance and they were turning around that book. And that's how I got into it. And I loved it. I mean, I started to do pre-law in college. I didn't follow through with that. I did marketing. I was finance. I was international finance and economics double major. And I didn't know if I wanted to be investment banking or what I wanted to do, but I did feel like when I learned about underwriting, it's putting marketing, there's a legal aspect to it, there's a financial aspect to it, there's a relationship aspect. And I loved how it just brought all of that together. And I think insurance sometimes gets not a bad rap, but it's an overlooked career. And
yeah,
I think the world of it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it is interesting that when I ask that question a lot, obviously, and most people have very similar experiences, which is some semi-accidental way of getting into it. Like you ran into something, it sounded interesting, and you kind of followed it. So just in terms of, you know, you've had a pretty long career now, a lot of success. You know, what would you recommend to anyone that wants to have a successful career in insurance?
Do it. Learn about it. Get to know people. Network. I mean, that's the biggest thing. It's your support system and people that you know, and don't have any pride. Ask a lot of questions and become an expert in a certain area. I think that always bodes well, but I just feel like there's so much opportunity in insurance. And I mean, there's people I talk to who are majoring in fine arts or art history in college. And actually somebody I just know is working for a brokerage that graduated college, art history major, and they're doing, art coverage, specie or, you know, whatever they call it. And, it's just, you can, whether it's poli sci or communication, some of these I don't want to say overlooked, but some of these, I think insurance can be a great first career for people who study in certain fields and then realize they don't want to go directly into the traditional routes in that field.
Yeah.
And I mean, the art insurance, and there's somebody I met that does an MGA for electric scooters. That's all they do. They provide insurance for those electric scooters that you see. So it's like, there's just so many angles to go into.
Because insurance is everywhere and it covers so many things. Yeah, it makes sense.
I don't know if I answered your question. I went off on a little rant about
I think so. I think it was, you know, just jump in. You know, there's a lot of things that you know, you can do in insurance, and that's kind of the answer. Jump in, build your network, you know, learn a lot about different things. I think that's an answer. Right. So I think this is the last question. Sometimes something else will pop in my head the last second, but you know, you can directly address our audience. What would you like to say to them?
Directly address.
And sorry, let me clarify. Yeah. So the audience, who's the audience? It is brokers, underwriters, cybersecurity folks. That's going to be most of the audience. I think it's people sort of.
Mm-hmm. And do you look for business related? Or is it?
It can be anything at all. Anything at all you'd love to address the audience with.
Well, that's a tough one, Anthony.
Sorry, it's I love to throw crazy questions out there. It's just kind of
fun
to
see your response. You got me on that one. I would say to the audience, think through this. For the brokers out there, contact us. Give us an opportunity for your customer to provide insurance.
Well, thanks, Anthony. It was a pleasure having you on.
Yeah, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity. This was great.
I enjoyed the chat, and it was
likewise.
If you want to learn more about our host Anthony or his company Aceris, visit aceris.com. aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time. you want to learn more about our host Anthony or his company Aceris, visit aceris.com. aceris.com. Thanks to our friends at Savoo for producing this episode with us. See you next time.